Today, Schrödinger's economy. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Tarek Booker for our Friday afternoon chat. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you?
Pretty good. Lot going on. Only 2 weeks since our last chat, but I'll tell you what, there's a mile of stuff gone on.
Oh, there certainly has. It's very much, you know, as we first discussed, I think it was late in 2019, you know, may you live in interesting times. And they've certainly been interesting since then, and particularly in recent weeks with everything with the bond market, with yields rising and, you know, Powell's recent statement. You know, I mean, it's all the same trade these days.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. And I think we can't ignore what's going on over in the Fed land, right? Because clearly our own economy is reacting to some extent to what the Fed has been doing. And it is pretty interesting what Powell didn't say in his press conference a couple of days ago, which, you know, is more of the same. We're going to keep rates as low as long as we need to. We'll go on doing our quantitative easing and bond buying. And no chance of inflation anytime soon. I'm not even thinking about inflation. And as for putting rates up, forget it.
It's quite fascinating. Last night, the Philadelphia Fed released their manufacturing index, and the prices paid sub-index of that particular manufacturing index ended up coming out at its highest level since 1980, since Jimmy Carter was president. Now, if you sort of graph out the prices paid sub-index of the Philadelphia Feds, and then you put it up against core CPI for the US, you're currently looking at somewhere between 4% and 5% inflation if that long-term correlation remains. And of course, the bond market's looking at that and going, oh crap, we're not even, I mean, you know, meanwhile, you know, 10-year borrowing costs are still only 1.75%, and we're talking about potentially, you know, 4% to 5% inflation.
Yes. Well, you know, if you believe all of those figures, then absolutely right. I've got a theory about this, and that is that all of this talk about inflation is actually being driven by the banks, because in 3 or 4 weeks, they're going to need to buy a lot more bonds because the SLR, the liquidity ratio, is changing. It was artificially reduced by a couple of percent a few months ago, because of COVID, right, which meant they needed to hold less, but they need more bonds now. So it'd be rather advantageous if the bond price was a lot lower when they had to buy all these extra bonds.
It is. I mean, like that, you know, well, we've seen banks and investment banks and, you know, the sort of, what they call them, the octopuses of Wall Street, you know, that have got their tentacle and everything, you know, manipulate prices in, you know, precious metals. They've, you know, LIBOR, all these different things. They've, you know, and this isn't just me speculating. They've actually been convicted of doing these things.
They got found out.
Yeah, exactly.
And the point is, if they got found out on that bit, how much else are they not being found out about?
Well, I mean, that raises a rather, you know, interesting question, doesn't it? Especially when you're talking about, not about, you know, LIBOR or precious metals. You're talking about, you know, treasuries. You're talking about something that is absolutely key to the core functioning of the financial system and of the US economy. But by the same token, I think there's also risks in that. I mean, like, you can see from the Fed's purchases of TIPS, which are inflation-linked bonds, you can see from that the Fed is trying to sort of front-run and create this narrative of inflation. But by the same token, if we've got this sort of situation in the manufacturing sector and in shipping, where basically you're just trying to hammer this massive square peg into a round hole, and while, you know, I tend to agree with you and, you know, Steve and, you know, say Brett Johnson from, you know, Santiago Capital, like people like that, on in terms of the long-term deflationary trend, I do wonder in these next, say, 3, 6, 9 months, depending how long it takes to resolve these supply chain issues, if they can be resolved to the market satisfaction. I mean, if we're going to be able to see, you know, short-term burst of a strong inflationary impulse that could absolutely scare the crap out of the bond market.
Well, it's certainly possible. And of course, Powell did say that there could be some transitory, you know, peaks. And, you know, we saw that even in the Australian context, right? So the last CPI that came out showed a very significant spike in childcare costs. Well, the reason for that was that previously, as part of the COVID support package, they were paid for a period of time. And of course, when that stopped, the cost of childcare went up. Now, that's one example of, you know, a transitory thing. But the shipping costs or the oil prices, those seem to me to be a little more structural. But I do want to come back to wages, because it seems to me that wages is going to be where this all is going to be, right? If we start seeing wages take off, then, you know, inflation is off with the races. But I'm not sure I'm going to see much in the way of income growth in real terms at the moment. Certainly in Australia, it's been flat since 2012. In the US, hasn't been a huge amount going on. But then the Biden stimulus package, the $1.9 trillion, you know, that's going to real people. So that could also drive a little bit more momentum in the short term. I guess it comes back to what your definition of inflation is. Is it measured in the right way? Probably not. There's an argument that I see quite often, and I think it's probably true, that if you measure inflation on the old method, they would have never lifted rates in 2005, 6, would never have created the global financial crisis, and therefore we wouldn't have had the current crisis, right? So in a way, the fact that it's understated through the metrics that they use is a big problem. But even if you take the metric that it's currently set at, yeah, it's going to definitely go up a bit. But as you say, the question is, will the bond market then say, ah, right, now this is real this time, or will they see through it? I don't know.
No, I don't know either. I mean, you know, you've got the likes of people like Bill Gross, who's the founder of PIMCO. You know, he used to be called Mr. Bond. You know, the bond, you know, well, a rival to Steve Van Meter of the Bond King. And, you know, he used to be arguably the largest hedge fund manager in the world. You know, PIMCO was absolutely huge. I mean, they're obviously rivals now. But, you know, back during the global financial crisis, you know, he was, you know, the head honcho, so to speak, and when it came to bonds. And he's talking about, you know, 3% inflation, 4% inflation. And, you know, obviously he's an incredibly experienced dude. I mean, he's been, you know, dealing with bonds longer than I've been alive. You know, by quite a significant margin. And you just got to ask, you know, is the bond market really going to sort of, you know, look, well, what do they say, look through the inflation? But to be completely honest, I'm not so sure they will, mostly because there is this fiscal stimulus. And not only that, but I feel like the political structure of the US is very much still in flux. You know, you've got Chuck Schumer hammering away on Biden to try and, you know, forgive $50,000 worth of student loans, which, you know, I mean, that's a huge, huge amount of money that you're talking about that the government basically shouldering. Or, I mean, because, you know, you can't just, you know, blip money out of existence. Well, we can't yet anyway. I mean, you know, I'm not going to say it's impossible, because who knows.
According to Steve Keen, you know, a jubilee is the only way to solve this problem.
Well, you know, maybe that will happen down the road. That's why I'm saying, you know, never saying never. But, you know, there is those sort of pushes in US politics towards these sorts of policies. And, you know, I think that there is the very real threat that the bond market gets spooked with the idea that they're basically just going to try and keep going with some level of ongoing fiscal stimulus forever and ever, because that's what the Democratic Party's left wing is increasingly demanding. I mean, you know, you listen to people say, like, Congressman Ro Khanna, or people like, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Bernie Sanders, you know, these sort of, you know, standard bearers for the American left, the left of the left, shall we say. And, you know, they are pressing, I mean, they're literally pressing in some ways for, you know, permanent stimulus checks every month until this is over. And, I mean, if you want inflation, that's how you get inflation.
Well, that's what I was hinting at, was that if, in fact, the money goes into the real economy and people then have more to spend, you know, either through income growth or through government payments, then there's a greater chance, I think, in that model of more inflation sooner, perhaps. And I think in the US, there is a bit of a sea change in terms of the thinking there. Although, I just wonder to what extent it will really stick and to what extent it will really impact. But, you know, in a way, it's also what the bond market thinks is going to happen, right? So if the bond market thinks that this is a signal, they're going to react.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the way I've really been looking at things more recently is it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't matter what anybody thinks or even what Chairman Powell thinks. It matters what the bond market thinks, like you say. And that's really the problem going forward, because you're trying to predict, you know, this incredibly complex system that's made up of, you know, millions of different individual people who are all acting in their own interest, all acting individually. And, you know, like, people have tried to say, oh, but we could just do yield curve control like we did in the 40s. And I really don't think that there's any comparison between now and the 40s, because the profit motive on Wall Street is even more powerful than it was then by several orders of magnitude. But also the fact that if you tried to sell off all your bonds as a fund manager back in, say, let's say 1947, there's every chance that someone would have turned around, called you unpatriotic, and claimed that you were a communist. Now, these days, everyone goes and just goes, you turn around and you sell all your bonds and you go, nice trade.
Well, that's the financialization of everything, isn't it? Which is effectively the, you know, the fundamental thing that we're up against. But let me just touch on Schrödinger's, right? Schrödinger's cat is, of course, what we're referring to. And it refers to a specific thought experiment that basically said, well, it's about probabilities, right? And basically what you do is you have a cat in a box and you have a particular isotope and you're not sure whether that isotope will decay in a particular way or not. And therefore, the question is, in that situation, is the cat dead or alive? And the answer is, well, both states are actually feasible, right? And you actually won't know which is right until you take the lid off and have a look in the box. But until that time, both states are potentially equally valid. And that's how I feel about what we're talking about, right? So inflation, deflation, well, I can build you a whole bunch of arguments as to why it could be inflationary. I can build you a whole bunch of arguments about why it could be deflationary. I can do the same with regard to quantitative easing. I can give you some arguments as to why it might work if you do enough of it. But I can also give you a whole bunch of arguments as to why it certainly won't work. Just look at Japan and the Eurozone and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Right, so almost each side of the argument, there are arguments both sides, but we won't know until we look. We won't know until we look later, right? And that's how I feel at the moment, right? So we've got these multiple states.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, my favorite visual interpretation of that is this meme that did the rounds about 4 or 5 years ago, and it's of a dining cabinet with a bunch of plates and bowls that have fallen up against the door. And you know, if you open the door, that they're all going to fall onto the ground and smash everywhere. So they're simultaneously, when you look at them, it is, you know, Schrödinger's cat, because they're simultaneously broken, yes, and not broken,
yes,
but you don't know exactly until you open the door. And I feel like that's what the global economy is like at the moment. Everything sort of, you know, everything isn't smashed at the moment, but once you take away the stimulus, aka opening the door, all of a sudden everything's going to fall out and, you know, there's every chance it's going to smash all over the floor.
Yeah, there's going to be a big bang. We know that there are going to be some casualties. We're just not quite sure what those casualties are going to be and what we do. And in a way, it's that postponing opening the door, you know, like just keep printing more and, you know, as Lowe said, well, we're going to go on doing the quantitative easing and, you know, QE2, 3, 4, whatever it takes, right? Whatever it takes, I've heard that before, Mario Draghi. yeah, it is just one of those things. But, you know, at some point, you've got to open the door, I suppose.
You do. And that's an interesting point regarding Lowe and the yield curve control, because at the moment, you know, they are trying to cap yields at 0.1% on the 3-year Australian Treasury bond. But then by the same token, we're seeing these sort of rather significant pressures upward. I mean, at the moment, the US 2-year Treasury bond is trading for as much as 0.18%, so almost double on a shorter duration bond. And obviously, you know, purely looking at it from an overseas fund manager's perspective, it's a lot easier to hedge yen into dollars, US dollars, than it is to hedge an Australian bond. So Australian short-term bonds at 3 years and below are starting to look less and less attractive to international investors. And there's a real real problem potentially coming for the RBA in two forms. One, you've got operation, the potential for Operation Twist 3.0, which basically means that the Fed takes short-term bonds, so, you know, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year bonds, and then sells them, which drives up the yield and they carry the interest rates on those bonds, and then they buy the ones at the long end, 10, 20, 30 years, to try and suppress the curve. Now, if that happens, we're going to see more and more pressure on the RBA's target, which creates problems for Governor Lowe and, you know, all the proponents of yield curve control. And then there's also the other side of things that says that, you know, purely based on the on the predicted levels of inflation coming from manufacturing indexes, you're potentially looking at, you know, inflation at 4% and the treasury, you know, 10-year treasuries at 3%. So you're talking about probably sort of nearly 100% increase in the current yield of bonds. And I think the RBA are going to be in a whole shed load of trouble if that happens, because if the 10-year bond gets anywhere near 3%, there's no way they're going to be able to reasonably defend the current target. They're going to have to abandon it.
And think about the impact on the currency, right? Because of course that's the other issue, right? The yield curves might drive bond rates, but there's the interrelationship at currency level as well. And one of the reasons why we've got issues as well at the moment is that the Aussie dollar is relatively high from where I think the Reserve Bank would like it, which means that we tend to import inflation rather than not. And it means also that our exports are not so competitive as they might be. So that's quite a big deal. But with regard to the RBA in the 3 years, I don't know whether you noticed that, but there was quite a significant period of time when it was above their target. And then it suddenly dropped down, and now it's sort of bouncing around the target and going up slightly. But what they did was they actually stopped the Treasury from essentially allowing their treasuries to be on lent to allow shorting of the three-year bond market, right? So it stopped that ability. What that means is that anybody trying to short now the three-year is going to have to pay a lot more than previously. So it's another example of, you know, free market's gone away. It's controlling another element to try and actually keep the thing in train. And interestingly, there was an FOI that came out yesterday from the RBA specifically relating to a discussion that they had in a paper that was published and presented to them about yield curve control. And it's worth reading. It's quite long, but it is worth reading because it actually outlines some of the thinking that clearly is influencing what they're doing.
It's interesting, like the way that the RBA did that. I mean, they literally just changed the rules. You know, it went from the cost of shorting that the particular, you know, the three year bond went up by something like, I think it was about 300%. So, you know, the upside there too short has been reduced significantly and basically to zero.
Yep.
But still, I mean, I think it's interesting that even now, even with the RBA's intervention, we're still seeing spikes of, you know, sort of 26, 27, 30% above their target level.
Yep.
So, I mean, I think, you know, I can't call where the bond market's going, because who knows? You know, I mean, you know, you're looking at the US 10-year as at a real inflection point at the moment. If it rips higher, it could rip a lot higher. But by the same token, it's encountering a zone that some people, that quite a few people who know far more about this than me, are calling, you know, a major zone of resistance.
Yep.
But if it does keep going up, you know, the RBA is going to have such enormous problems, because they've basically crossed the Rubicon alone here. Even the BOJ, you know, the Bank of Japan, has stepped back from their yield curve control. They've said that we were going to allow things to trade in a much, much greater range. You know, they're pulling back their purchases of ETFs and saying that we're only going to do more of them when they actually need to happen. So the RBA's really stuck out on a limb here by themselves. And unlike, say, the BOJ or the European Central Bank, they don't have the firepower or the clout to do that on their own.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think that's worth just reflecting on, right? Because, you know, they often say don't fight the Fed, because, of course, the Fed has huge resources, I would say unlimited resources. I wonder to what extent that's true about the RBA. Now, of course, a number of people are saying, the RBA's got plenty of firepower and they can go on doing this for a long, long time. But I'm conscious of the logarithmic impact of this. If you keep doing it, you've got to actually keep accelerating, right? And so the debt becomes ever more of an issue ultimately. Now, I guess it's also true to say that the economy is probably performing a little better than even the Reserve Bank said. So the Reserve Bank's forecast for unemployment and where we are now is about 10 months ahead at 5.8%, which is what came out the other day. So there are some signs of some recovery, but yet they're still saying we need unemployment to significantly lower. We need wages growth just to really start showing some improvement. That's not going to happen for a long time, and inflation is going to stay low, you know, for the next 2 or 3 years. So what they're basically saying is it's more of the same, only more so, of course, because of what we've just said, for some long time. And the question is, can they really go on doing that for 3 years in the context of higher US bond rates? Interesting question.
Well, I think the answer is no. I mean, realistically, you know, if you're talking about if US yields normalize to say 2018, early 2019 levels, so you're talking about a US 10-year at sort of 2.5%. That's going to be a pretty challenging environment to manage that type of control, that type of, you know, sort of hands-on, you know, sort of throat around the neck of the bond market, do as you're told sort of thing from the RBA. And, you know, it's going to be really, really difficult for them to do that, because if somehow the US manages to engineer even a temporary recovery using, you know, I mean, what is it, $1.9 trillion in stimulus from Biden, another $900 billion from Trump, which was done at the end of last year, plus another up to somewhere between $2 and $5 trillion from the infrastructure package that's coming. So, I mean, it's entirely possible that we could see this really, really strong K-shaped recovery, as we've been discussing in the past, that you've got this, you know, everything goes to the moon for the wealthy while everything stagnates or goes down the toilet for everybody else. But by the same token, that looks good in terms of headline GDP. It looks good in a lot of ways in terms of inflation. So, you know, there is that world in which things aren't really going that great for the real economy, but there is upward pressure on rates, which is an absolute nightmare scenario for basically everyone who isn't wealthy. And if you're an Aussie mortgage holder and that starts to feed into to rates here, which is entirely possible if we do see the US 10-year rise by another, 50 or 60% from where it is, you know, we could really start to see some major problems, because the RBA is completely unprepared for that. And them trying to hold the yield down in a lot of ways could end up doing more harm than good, because it's the old, you know, I mean, I think Peter Schiff was the one who popularized it, or it might've been Harry Dent, I forget, you know, the holding the beach ball underwater. Schiff. You know, you hold it, and then woof, all of a sudden it takes off. Yep. And you've lost control. And that's arguably to a small degree what's happening now, because the Fed is behind the curve. You know, they are now, you know, just saying, oh, it's all right, just you know, everything's going to be fine. But ignoring a problem in the bond market doesn't make it go away.
Well, absolutely. And the fact is, to take that analogy further, the further you pull the ball underwater and the longer you hold it, the bigger the release. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's always... Now, in terms of the local economy here, you know, that 5.8%, that was a better number than many people expected, and there are some, you know, good points to it. You know, mostly full-time jobs, significant increase in employment for young people and indeed women, but the underemployment rose. So that's, I think, a bit of concern. A lot of people perhaps doing the odd hour, and of course being defined as employed, so therefore in the numbers. Underemployment is one that I watch, but also of course the Roy Morgan equivalent of the employment numbers at 13%. So there's some fuzziness about those numbers. But what I'm interested in is the job keeper context here, right? Because at the end of March, we've got, what, 1 million on job keeper coming off, or give or take, or depending on how many, you know, what the latest number is. And the latest data that I've seen on that is actually quite interesting, because it's down to a postcode level and it's not uniformly distributed across the country. A lot of people around Victoria, and particularly in Melbourne, of course, because of the lockdowns, are still on JobKeeper. And there are hot spots in various other parts of the country. In fact, I published on my site in an earlier post some heat maps that showed specific areas where some of those hot spots were. But interestingly, those hot spots matched up remarkably well with my mortgage stress data. So what it tells me is that we've got this interesting phenomenon where there will be potentially people coming off JobKeeper at the end of March in areas where mortgage stress is already quite high. So you'd expect unemployment to rise, and you expect other negative economic indicators to begin to come through. And by the way, the retail numbers out today also weren't very strong either. So, you know, there's, again, it's back to Schrodinger's view. You know, there's some good news and there's some bad news, and we're not quite sure which way it's going to go.
Yeah, well, it's, I find it's a little bit like Superman and Clark Kent. You know, you've got in one hand, you've got, you know, Superman flying through the sky, you know, looking great, like our 5.8% unemployment number. And then you've got Clark Kent after he's been whammied with some kryptonite. And then all of a sudden things don't look so great. And the problem is that that in a lot of ways, the Australian economy is both those things. You know, on one hand, you know, you've got the great 5.8% unemployment number, but then you look at, say, you know, like as we've discussed in the past, at your savings data, the fact that 40% of Victorian households have little to no savings. So, like, the thing that I find really quite concerning is this, and my apologies if this ends up being a little bit long, but I sort of see the economy as a bit of a glass cannon. It looks very, very nice. It looks superbly powerful. But then by the same token, it's also quite fragile. And the problem with that is that you've got, okay, you know, you've got headline GDP numbers, which may actually end up looking quite good in Q1, Q2. But that only tells part of the story. You know, wealthy people going out and having lunch in Toorak or Mosman all adds to GDP, which is all lovely. Or they go and buy a Mercedes or a Lamborghini, or they go to Prada. That's all great in terms of headline GDP. But in terms of the real economy where most of us actually live, you know, as JobKeeper expires, it's hard to imagine how that doesn't turn into a negative feedback loop in these specific areas, as you say, because, you know, the people who are suffering most are concentrated in specific areas, it's not uniform. And that really is the problem, because if you've got, like, Frydenberg's plan is that everyone's going to spend, you know, that all these people who've built up this massive war chest of savings are going to spend. Now, data from the US, which admittedly isn't exactly perfect, but we don't really have the same equivalent here in Australia. Data from the US shows that the bottom 60% of households are actually burning through their savings, while the top 40% are building a war chest. And that's concentrated heavily in the upper, you know, the top 20%, which I imagine is probably more like the top 10%, or maybe even the top 1%. You don't know. But it really sort of illustrates the point that a lot of households don't have a whole lot to spend. So in this new, brave new world that Josh Frydenberg and Scott Morrison have created, what's going to happen if in these areas, if there isn't the spending, if as JobKeeper expires, people tighten their belts, as you would expect, you know, as they get their hours cut or as they lose their jobs, and then there's no savings, you know, there's no guy from Toorak who's saved up $200,000 who's going to go around and splash his cash at local businesses, you know, in a place like, you know, Cranbourne South. Or places like that that are suffering. Now, I'm sorry to single out Cranbourne, and you know I have some friends there. But at the end of the day, those are the areas that are suffering the most, and they are going to continue to suffer.
Yep.
And the problem is I don't really see any government policy or any shift in the economy that's going to change that in the short to medium term.
No, well, of course, this whole question of those high growth corridors, and you know, I'm looking at places like Point Cook and Werribee, down the long, you know, to use a couple of examples in and around Melbourne. I'd also say that some of those large growth corridors have had very significant numbers of people come in there. A lot of migration, of course, as well, which sort of may actually be another little factor to bear in mind, because, of course, migration is still negative at the moment. And there's an interesting question ahead as to what's going to happen about that. Certain prime ministers in Australia seem to be signalling we should be increasing our migration and quickly, which is interesting, right? Particularly for wages growth, right? Because how are we going to keep wages nice and low, and we'll actually bring in a lot of people who can actually do the low paid jobs. The sign doesn't add up there.
Honestly, I find it all a bit astounding, to be completely frank. No, I mean, truthfully, like, I mean, according to the latest Centrelink data, you're talking about 1.4 million people are claiming unemployment benefits. 1.4 million. Now, that's something around about 11% of the labor force. Now, we can talk about, you know, what the real unemployment rate is until the cows come home, but that's what the figures say.
Yeah.
You know? And that is, for a start, that is huge. And then there's the Roy Morgan numbers. And now, in an act of what can only be described as political bastardry. And I very deliberately said that. They're talking about allowing Australians to be continue to be stranded overseas while they bring in migrants to fill skill shortages. And I don't know about you, but that just seems insane.
When I heard about it and read it, I was thinking, well, that just proves it. That proves that we are actually playing a game of quantitative easing via migration. My theory was, by the way, that we've been actually doing quantitative easing for a good number of years, but ours is actually quantitative easing based on people, right? Bringing people in, keeping wages down, creating GDP growth. But if you look at GDP per capita, it's not been going in the right same direction, right? So we've had a long-term issue here. And so now, of course, with the negative migration this year and probably next year as forecast in the Treasury numbers, they want to turn that around. Why? Because if they can get more people to come in, that actually increases the GDP number, but it's going to have a very big impact on people's original incomes here. The other point, of course, is there are lots and lots and lots of high-rise developments vacant at the moment. So they want some mugs, sorry, they want some people to come and live in them. And given the problems with cracks and flammable cladding and all those things, it might be quite convenient to get people to come in from overseas and put them into those high-rise. I mean, maybe I'm being cynical in my own right, but I've heartfelt feeling that's part of the story.
So what you're saying is we need some migrants. I mean bag holders. Oh no, sorry, migrants was right the first time. But yeah, it's ridiculous. It really is. I mean, oh, I don't know. I mean, I look back at the historic figures for migration for Australia from, the sort of late 80s through to the GFC, and migration fell off a cliff after the 90s recession. I think I believe from the peak in the late 1980s all the way through to the middle of the 90s, migration fell by something like around about 80% net overseas migration. And I mean, realistically, that's what we need to see now. We could still have, quite solid migration in terms of, like family reunions, partner visas, all these different things that you need to have in a functioning country. Because you can't just say, oh, no, we're shutting the door, get stuffed. That's just ridiculous. But by the same token, the idea that we should keep importing people on 457 visas and people to pick fruit for, apparently as little as $1.25 an hour, effectively, according to some news articles today. It's just nuts. But you know what really gets me is this, is we have seen probably, arguably one of the greatest series of political train wrecks in Australian history unfold recently, with everything that happens with the alleged rape of Brittany Higgins, of what happened of the allegations with Christian Porter, of Robodebt, of all these different things that have happened over the last 18 months. And Scott Morrison still has an approval rating that is equal to the highest ever of Bob Hawke, even after presiding over that absolute train wreck. And I just got to say, I mean, can you imagine, John Howard or any other government, even Malcolm Turnbull, turning around and saying to the 40,000 Australian Aussies who are stranded overseas, get stuffed. We're going to bring in, our committee has said we're going to bring in some migrants instead of you.
Yeah.
I can't see it.
No, I agree absolutely. Well, he does seem to be. We said it before, titanium plated and able to, see everything off. But just reflect on the Western Australian election briefly, right? Because now, was that just local factors, do you think? Or do you think that tells us something about what people are really thinking?
I think it's local factors are obviously definitely a big factor. I mean, Mark McGowan is a very, very popular guy. He managed to cut out a very nice political niche for himself since all of this started. And the border closures have been very popular. And to be completely honest, it's kind of easy to understand why, just from a, sort of broader perspective. WA has had the best time of things of any Australian state. And not only that, but they've also had the renewed sort of, I mean, I wouldn't quite call it a full-fledged mining boom, but let's call it a mini mining boom. in iron ore prices that has, helped the budget and make Mark McGowan and the Labor Party in WA look like superstars in terms of budgetary management. So, that's obviously a fairly significant, tailwind in their favour. Now, in terms of whether or not WA is a concern for, at a federal level as a result, I think that considering the large majority of federal seats that the Liberal Party and the Nationals hold in WA, I would say it's definitely ringing some alarm bells. But by the same token, I don't think they're reading too much into it, because it's also the power of incumbency at the moment. You saw the Queensland election, that the Labor won handily there. And not only that, but it's something that you're really seeing quite a lot around the world. I mean, unless it's something, unless it's like an enormous political train wreck, say like, the US presidential election, where, there was a whole bunch of different factors, and anything involving Trump, let's be honest. So that is, and there's all the issues with the media and, COVID and everything else, and that obviously complicated that immensely. But generally speaking, you're seeing quite a lot of support for incumbents. I mean, I think we discussed it a few weeks ago when we talked about Boris Johnson, and despite the fact that Britain is struggling horribly, he's still, he's still looked upon quite favourably.
Yes, he is. And even now, even with all of the issues with regards to vaccine supply and everything else, he's still doing very well. And I think that's interesting. Incumbency in the time of crisis is probably pretty strong. But there is an ideological thrust that I see in Australian politics, and particularly in ScoMo's team. And I just think the responsible lending is a good example of that, right? Now, I don't know whether you've been following the responsible lending, the repeal of responsible lending, but that bill went back into the Senate this week and was expected to be voted on. In fact, it never came to a vote. And the reason it never came to a vote is because the opposition and the crossbenchers just refused to play ball with it, because their view is that responsible lending is about empowering the banks essentially to lend more, shifting all the power to the banks away from consumers, and saying to consumers, it's your fault if you get into debt, you don't need protection at all. And in fact, more and more of the crossbench and even within Labor are beginning to wake up to the ideological stance that bill represents. And in fact, if you've not read the Senate inquiry report, there's a very, very good dissenting report from the Greens, who actually, I think, make all the right points around the ideological nature of what responsible lending was trying to do. And I see it again and again, this ideological stance that they're taking, which is going right back to the K, it's going right back to the big end of town and supporting, big business. And if you want another example of supporting big business, JobKeeper, how many of those big firms who actually benefited from JobKeeper didn't need it in the first place and are now paying superior profits as a result? That is a scandal, and yet nobody really wants to think about it.
No, that's because nobody cares. That's the problem in all of this. I mean, as far as a lot of people are concerned, it rained free money from the sky. ScoMo is therefore the sun god of milk and honey, and everything's going to be great forever and ever. And I mean, that's literally how people are basically seeing it. I mean, I've even spoken to people who are sort of ardent supporters of the Labor Party. And I criticized JobKeeper, and holy crap, were they annoyed. Jesus. I'm like, JobKeeper was a disaster of a policy. We spent tens of billions of dollars giving money to people who didn't need it. And if you criticize it, you're seen as, and people just go, well, but we couldn't have just done nothing. It's like, well, that's not the point.
You could have done something different.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. We could have done like the UK. We could have had a scheme that was only for people who were definitively impacted. Or we could have had a scheme like New Zealand which was a much tighter criteria. But instead, now we've got, Prime Minister Morrison coming out and saying, oh, I prefer our companies to be profitable than non-profitable. What kind of answer is that?
It's called a stupid answer, because it doesn't actually address the fundamental question that was asked in the first place. He's actually very good at that, isn't he? Coming back to an answer that goes around the corner, and then you sort of lost the point. But it is worth just reflecting on what proportion of that massive amount of money went to places that it should have never gone to in the first place? And more importantly, what about the moral perspective here, right? There are some companies who actually, good on them, have actually said, yeah, we didn't need it and we've paid it back, right? But there's a whole bunch of saying, ha, 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 great, we'll just pay the shareholders and let's carry on. So there's a moral thing here as well, I think.
Well, I mean, without the moral leadership of the Prime Minister to at least turn around and at least place some political pressure on them. I mean, look, from a legal perspective, there's not really a whole lot we can do. You know, you can't just say to them, oh, well, you didn't need the money, give it back. But from a political perspective, the Prime Minister could at least turn around and go, well, you know, I think that given, you know, the spirit of Australians and, you know, the idea that we should all do our part and, you know, that we're all about a fair go, I think that those who didn't need it should pay it back. You know, I mean, okay, you're probably only going to recoup maybe $200 million from, you know, just the absolute, you know, sort of most, you know, publicly exposed in terms of public relations. But by the same token, I mean, like you say, it's about a moral thing. I find it a little bit ridiculous that Morrison crafted, implemented, and then completely made a mess of the robo-debt system, you know, which Peter Van Onselen covered in exhaustive detail quite well, that it was basically Morrison's baby from start to finish. And he's the one who basically was the architect of the entire policy, its implementation, and its ultimate failure. And, you know, we chased these people, 2,000 of whom ended up dead afterwards. Now, the link between the deaths and the actual debts hasn't been entirely determined in, obviously, a lot of those cases, but let's just leave that aside. But it's just a bit ridiculous that we chase these people. I think it was, you know, 500,000 people for something like $550 million.
Mm. Absolutely.
And that is something that we pissed away in maybe a week and a half of JobKeeper payments to companies who didn't need it.
Mm. Gives you a bit of context, doesn't it, for some of the decisions that are taken. And, you know, another example of that was a couple of years ago after the pollies were dragged into the Royal Commission into the financial services sector, right? At the end of that, I remember them standing up and saying how disgraceful the banks were and, you know, they should really do better and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? Now, where's all that gone, right? I'm going to go back to that responsible lending discussion, right? The responsible lending recommendation out of the Royal Commission was do not change that. It's really important, right? Our recommendation is do nothing to it, right? And of course, that's the one thing that they were trying to change. So we've got this sort of void of, I don't know whether it's morals or whether it's a void in terms of, you know, why they're doing it. Or is it just that they swing back to their core center of gravity, which is the big end of town, supporting the big end of town, never mind everybody else. And maybe that's just the natural setting of that particular part of government. But it's a disgrace.
I don't think it is the default setting. I think, like, the rank and file members of the Liberal Party, you know, people who've been, you know, part of the party at a local level for something like 40 years, that's not their view. That's not their values. And I don't think, to be honest, in a lot of ways, I don't think it's the values of a lot of Liberal voters either. I think that they just don't like the alternative in the form of Albanese or Shorten. You know, I don't think it's necessarily about the core ideology at the heart of the Liberal Party. I think it's a problem with the core ideology of Scott Morrison and Josh Frydenberg's Liberal Party. But I don't think it is at the value, you know, at the values of general, you know, sort of, you know, right wing conservative people who are, you know, focused on things like, you know, like things like, you know, family values or small government, all these different things. But at the end of the day, there's still a care about people and freedom and these different things. And I mean, like, you know, say robo-debt, for example. I mean, where's the freedom in that? Where's the freedom in accusing someone of something that they didn't do, forcing them to pay a fine for something they didn't do, and then not even having the proper mechanisms to challenge that? From a right-wing conservative perspective, that is a freaking horrible policy.
Absolutely. Well, you could add another one, the small and medium enterprise sector of the economy, which got very little support really through JobKeeper. And I would argue that is completely undervalued by many within, you know, the governing party at the moment. And yet the SME sector is the dynamo of Australia. And they might play lip service, but actually what they do in practice is actually not support that sector of the economy at all.
Yeah, and that's what I think is so interesting at the moment. Like, you know, the government's government-backed small and medium enterprise loan scheme was an utter failure. You know, less than $3 million were lent out of $40 billion that was budgeted. So you're talking about less than 10%. You know, so all these companies that could have survived and prospered are now basically zombies as a result. You know, that, you know, surviving just on JobKeeper and whatever they could get their hands on from state and territory governments. And it's just a bit ridiculous, really. And that now the government's turned around and said, oh yeah, but we're gonna do more government backed small and medium enterprise loans. And I look at the reports and I just go, how is this, how are we talking about this like it's a good thing? You know, the number one talking point should be, this didn't work last time, why is it gonna work now?
Well, yeah, but the fact of the matter is, solving businesses that actually are on the edge by giving them more chance to borrow more money, just nuts, right? Because essentially what it says is that the ones who are actually close to the edge or who are unlikely to succeed will say, well, I can't do it anyway, right? Whereas those who would have borrowed anyway will now be able to borrow more cheaply than previously. So again, what you're doing is you're supporting the wrong people.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the core problem at the heart of monetary policy. It's this idea that you lower rates and therefore businesses will invest and businesses will create jobs. But if you look at business investment as a percentage of GDP, since the end of the mining boom, it's fallen off a cliff. Where, you know, even prior to COVID, there's a good chart from the RBA, if you can just whack it up on the screen. And it's, you're talking about, you know, business investment prior to COVID was around about the same level as it was at the bottom of the 90s recession. So things were already going poorly. That transfer mechanism is already completely broken. And the problem is that now, not only that, but while the government's turned around and said, oh, it's okay, just get a loan from the banks, you know, we've got the government back things, it's gonna happen, blah, blah, blah. I spoke to a representative of one of the major banks in April last year, and they told me exactly this would happen. Now, I don't think the government are idiots, and I'm fairly certain if they sat down with the big four, they would have turned around and said, well, this isn't going to work. Yet, by the same token, they continue to persist with this idea that businesses are going to borrow, and more than that, that they're going to be allowed to borrow. Meanwhile, there was a report in the AFR the other day that said that the criteria for business lending and, you know, business credit in general continues to tighten, which doesn't really speak to an economy that's actually undergoing a sustainable and organic recovery.
No, absolutely right. And interestingly, going back to responsible lending for a second, right, there is a furphy in there arguing that, well, of course, if you abolish responsible lending, it will be easier for SMEs to borrow, right? Just remember this, responsible lending was never actually aligned to SMEs in the first place. So that's the first point. The second is, banks have been tightening their criteria for lending to SMEs for years. And that's more to do with the Basel rules, where effectively the amount of capital you need to hold for a SME loan is a lot higher than for a mortgage. And third point is, if you go on making it that banks should be encouraged to lend more and more for mortgage purposes, it's going to suck more and more ability to be able to lend to the business sector. So the settings are wrong. You don't solve it by trying to actually play around within responsible lending and then use it as an excuse to try and actually pull the wool over the eyes of the crossbench and Labour to say, you've got to vote for this because you're supporting small business. And by the way, that responsible lending change was actually called, you know, economic recovery stuff. So basically what they're saying is, if you vote against it, you're actually voting against economic recovery. That's all. That's spin. That's not real. That's spin.
Well, it's classic US. It's classic sort of early 2000s US politics to me. You know, it's like attaching a rider to a bill. A rider is just basically an amendment that basically just, you know, it can be completely unrelated. You know, say for example, we're going to open up this new Air Force base, but we're also going to give money to these particular organizations that are politically allied with us, for example. And it's just a bit ridiculous, but it just speaks volumes to the sort of environment that we're currently in, really, to be completely honest with you. You know, we're in this situation where you've got owner-occupier housing credit at or near record highs. You've got first home, you know, the number of first home buyers buying property at or near record highs. And it's just nuts that they just want to throw more fuel on the fire. And I think it comes back to a discussion that we've had in the past and that you've covered quite extensively, that one third of households are the households who by far carry the vast majority of the debt. And what we've seen in recent months and recent years is people, specifically older households, paying down their debts, paying off their homes, and, you know, getting to the point where they're debt free. But the problem is there's all these younger households going out there, leveraging themselves up to their eyeballs, and they're creating a much, much greater problem down the road. Because younger households, I mean, I believe households around about the age of 38 and 45 are the number one consumers. They spend by far the most, more than any other demographic. And what we've done here in Australia is we've saddled them with a shed load of debt. And the BIS has confirmed this in their own research that high levels of household debt basically kneecap an economy's growth potential once it reaches a certain rate. And Australia's is well past that particular threshold. And we've saddled our key spending demographics with shed loads of debt. So now they can't. Now instead of going out there and buying new cars or, you know, supporting local businesses, they're eating 2-minute noodles and watching Netflix instead. And it's not good for the economy, and it's not good for the country.
No, and that's where you're touching on a very important point, which is that there is within the Reserve Bank and probably within Treasury a very strong Keynesian view of the world, right? And in there, debt isn't actually measured as being important at all. Right. The argument is that for every debt, there's an asset. So therefore, it doesn't matter if debt goes up because the assets go up. Right. They cancel each other out. Except one, the debt distribution you've touched on is the critical point. And two, there is a point beyond which debt becomes irretrievable. You can't pay it off. You'll never pay it off. And effectively, you then simply become wage slaves to be able to continue to service that debt into old age. And that's great for the financial sector. It's great for, other people. But actually, for those individuals concerned, and for the broader economy, that's a real problem. And the problem is that the more you pay to try and service debt, the more you're unable to spend that on goods and services and other things, which means that effectively you're sucking the air out of the rest of the economy. That's the true story. And that's really why Schrödinger's cat is such a good analogy, right? Because effectively you've got this upside downside thing going on, but the truth is in the middle, we're half dead.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, you know, all you need to do is walk. I mean, I think, say, for example, you know, to extend the analogy, you think about, say, retail sales, right? While they have come down in some of the recent figures, they're still about 8% year on year higher than where they were prior to COVID. And I think that sort of really sort of speaks to the problem, because if you walk around the average neighborhood In a lot of different places in Australia, and I mean even in some of the affluent areas where I've sort of, you know, gone on a bit of an explore recently to just, you know, take the pulse, you know, in these different areas of Sydney, it, you know, you see these, you know, you go to these areas where, you know, the houses are $2 million, $3 million, $4 million, and there's still empty shops. You know, people are still not spending enough to support their local businesses, and this is being exacerbated by the rise of the, you know, the sort of enormous online retailers and just online retail in general. And that sucks money out of the real economy, because instead of having someone who's, you know, working the cashier, who, you know, the cashier in the store, the assistant in the store, the manager, you know, the person doing stock out the back, instead there's just one stock guy who packs orders and then sends them to people on, you know, through the post. So, you know, you're seeing this really uneven recovery in the economy. And I don't think that that's really being priced into probably, I'd say, the majority of the different forecasts.
I agree. Well, you know, I went referring to what I said earlier on, there are bank economists who would love to talk up inflation because it's in their own interest to talk up inflation, right? And maybe some of those forecasters are also being a bit too optimistic because they're actually swallowing the spin from the Reserve Bank. But I think the truth is rather different. I think the Schrödinger's model is a very good one to sort of keep in the back of your mind and remember that, you know, there are alternative futures here, and yet it's uncertain. And the degree of uncertainty that I think we're going to see over the next few months is a lot higher than you know, many people expect. Even if, and you know, let's be frank here, even if the unemployment rate was better than you and I expected a few months ago.
Exactly. I mean, to be honest, like I said, you know, we said previously, you know, I think that there are still some fairly significant questions about that. You know, there's issues of people were still working 0 hours. I mean, and you know, you've really got to wonder how many of them are going to have a job at the end of all this once JobKeeper does conclude. And then there's obviously all the other people who've effectively been working for free. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, if you've got free labor, why not use it?
Yeah.
You know, but I think it's going to take time for all this to sort of unfold, because it's going to be really, really distorted and patchy in terms of the figures. Because, you know, we may see, you know, quite decent retail figures as the more affluent spend their war chests as the economy sort of continues to reopen. But by the same token, that doesn't really help, you know, the shopkeeper and the families in lower socioeconomic areas who are experiencing mortgage stress, who are experiencing, you know, the after effects of lockdowns and just, you know, the lack of business due to, you know, COVID-related things, or even just, you know, the organic, you know, struggle of the economy.
Yeah, well, what you're saying there is Schrödinger's even there on the high street.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Tarek, I appreciate your time today. That's been a very interesting exploration of a whole bunch of very important issues. And at the end of it, as normal, you know, we come away thinking, well, there is some good stuff and there's some not so good stuff. So I guess we'll keep tracking and come back and talk again down the track.
Sounds good, mate.
Thanks for your time today.